pack gas for cheese. Bullets of wings at light speed. Taking your pretty wife's life and sacrificing your seed. Indeed, we let them bleed for 50 G's. Ship his body to the States, filled with 50 keys. Please, no remorse for your two-face. It's hot assemble. My rifle out the motherfucking suitcase. You about to take whose place? Not safe. Your body will be laced and left without a trace.
The glamour life, the glamour life, yo. Yo, it's the glamour life. Blow up the kids and the wife. Players who ain't half.
Woke up in sunny Manchester. Yo, this is Roots Manuva on CKUT on 90.3 Montreal. Check it out.
Travel near, travel far. It's sickly bizarre. Ain't a sound that play so. Ain't a sound that stay so. Relevant to all soldier movement. Bringing improvement. Bashment improvement. To the dump stack. High quality supply.
This sucks. We know. So why not join us for a cool show? Exploring the state of Canada's cursed media landscape this Saturday, January 20th. It's at St. Jack's Center in downtown Montreal. It's the inaugural edition of the Harbinger Showcase live recording series. Come and hang out with Rob Russo, Harris Marks, and Nashua Khan. It's a media criticism panel conversation with guests tabling from Palestinian Youth Movement, Breach Media, The Rover, People, CUTV, Sierra Club Canada, and more, plus an after party connecting left journalists and activist communities. Yeah, it's a Saturday, January 20th, 8 p.m. at St. Jack's, 1439 St. Catherine West. It's $15 at the door, and the venue's licensed BYOB, so bring some drinks and friends for a great night of media criticism. It's like Canada Land, but anti-Zionist. Hopefully see you there. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including Toronto CIUT, Winnipeg CKUW, Montreal CKUT, and Vancouver Co-op Radio, featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring more than 60 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Support the community for just $5 a month and get a new release from Between the Lines or Fernwood Publishing at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we explain how capitalism creates insecurity to sustain itself with writer Astra Taylor on Tech Won't Save Us, reflect on Western values and the Anglo-American Empire's decline with Kasachin News' Camilla Press on 49th Parallel, and explore the reactionary rise of the evangelical movement in prairie politics with ex-youth pastor Dallas Verdi on Unmaking Saskatchewan. But first,
news sucks, we know. So why not join us for a cool show? Exploring the state of Canada's cursed media landscape this Saturday, January 13th. It's at the St. Jack's Center in downtown Montreal. It's the inaugural edition of the Harbinger Showcase live podcast recording series. Come and hang out with Rob Russo, Harris Marks, and Nashua Khan. It's a media criticism panel combo with special guests from Palestinian Youth Movement, Breach Media, Sierra Club Canada, and more, plus an after party connecting left journalists and activist communities. Ridiculous. It's happening this Saturday, January 13th from 8 p.m. at the historic St. Jack's Center at 1439 through St. Catherine West. Tickets are $15 and the venue's licensed BYOB. So bring some drinks and friends for a great night of media criticism. It's like Canada Land, but anti-Zionist. Hopefully see you there. Ahem. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a new episode, Team Advantage welcome independent journalist and Big Shiny Takes on the Forgotten Corner co-host Jeremy Appel for a conversation examining the historical roots and basic assumptions that underlie Zionism as Israel continues its genocidal rampage through Gaza. Here's the show.
it's awesome that Hamas now has like a more woke position on whether like Judaism and Zionism are inherently linked than the United States Congress. It's actually really good. Makes no difference where I'm the Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This independent, listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/AlbertaAdvantage. Welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today are Roberta.
Hello.
Rory.
Hi.
Joel.
Hi there.
And friend of the podcast, journalist Jeremy Appel.
Thanks for having me, as always.
And thank you very much for joining us once again. As our listeners are likely aware, since the October 7th incursion into the 67 borders of Israel by Hamas, the Israeli military has been engaged in an all-out assault against the Gaza Strip, bombing hospitals, refugee camps, and essential infrastructure while killing tens of thousands of civilians, including dozens of journalists and aid workers in their supposed hunt for Hamas militants. At the time of recording, an estimated 17,000 Palestinians have been killed in this conflict. The past few days have been so deadly that I imagine by the time you are listening to this, that number will have increased. At the same time as this latest attack on Gaza, Israeli settlers have been increasing their attacks on Palestinian homes and villages in the occupied West Bank, which is continuing a decades-long expansion that the United Nations, the Red Cross, and the International Court of Justice, among others, have ruled illegal and as a violation of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. At the same time, criticisms of Israel, criticisms of Zionism are increasingly penalized and censored in the West, as well as really increasingly dismissed as anti-Semitic, even when they come from other Jews. And Western powers are increasingly ignoring really wildly growing concerns among their citizens to unquestioningly defend the state of Israel, to provide it with cover internationally for its crimes, as well as material support, often in the forms of armaments, weapons, and other technology. When we were putting this episode together, the questions that sort of generated it for us were looking at why is Israel so murderous and so deadly of a state? Like, how is it that in 2023, we have this wildly disproportionate violence that is being deployed? So you've got a technologically advanced military backed by the most powerful country in the world, the United States of America, and it is being used against a stateless refugee population in one of the most densely populated areas on Earth, half of the population of which are children, in an area that they are not allowed to leave. So how does this make sense, even internally to the state of Israel? How does this make sense in terms of our own governments, Western governments, and how is this violence being defended and justified by other global powers and other people? How have we got to a situation where this kind of violence can happen and can be justified by the people doing it and by the people allowing it to happen? What we're going to do is we're going to start by examining some very basic assumptions that underlie Zionism, that underlie the existence of the state of Israel. And we're really going to kind of take our time with them, unpack them a bit, because at this point, they've been repeated so much that they're taken as natural, as if they just erupted from the earth, like they're a geologic formation. And they kind of slide off people's brains when they hear them for that reason. And we want to interrogate some of the things that you've probably heard about Israel all of your life. And we, in doing so, we're hoping that this will give you a bit of a quick theoretical roadmap to where we come from, where we're going, where we're headed. And we're going to be talking about things like settler colonialism, apartheid, genocide, fascism, and the structure of and the claims of anti-Semitism that are being made.
So let's start with some basic facts. Israel is a Jewish state. This is what's called Zionism. It's kind of a weird thing. Most people hear this and they kind of excuse it, saying, yeah, I guess a state for Jewish people makes sense. But we really need to kind of examine this with a little bit more scrutiny, because it's really at the core of the issue. For example, if you expressly or by implication oppose, quote, the existence of the state of Israel as the state of the Jewish people, end quote, you are prohibited from being elected to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Bills in the Knesset can be prevented from being discussed if they go against the idea of Israel as an explicitly Jewish state. Israel's security service, the Shin Bet, sees part of its role being to thwart the activity of any group or individual seeking to harm the Jewish and democratic character of the state of Israel. And this includes going after individuals conducting subversive activity against the Jewish identity of the state. So this isn't just like there happens to be a lot of Jewish people in Israel and it's reflected in their policy, but rather the case is that Israel actively filters for and cultivates support for its character as a Jewish state. And again, this is the kind of thing that like typically just gets said in public in the media and just kind of like passes. It doesn't get any scrutiny, slides over people's brains. And that's mostly because people know Jewish people and think they're very nice. And of course, they should have their own country, I guess. So what's the big deal? And sometimes criticizing this idea will even get depicted in terroristic terms. Like, someone is like, I'm not sure if Israel should be an explicitly Jewish state. They'll get depicted as like a terrorist. You're opposed to the existence of a Jewish state, or you want to destroy Israel as a Jewish state. And then they light their hair on fire, or whatever. What gets glossed over in those sentences is how exclusive and how discriminatory this specific kind of state is. And it's in this exclusive and discriminatory character that that's the issue at the core of so much of what is going on.
And I think what you're bringing up here, Joel, is very important, because one of the ways that you will often hear Israel defended in the media and by our politicians is as, quote, the only democracy in the Middle East. And when you just scratch the surface, as we have here, of looking at things where, you know, you're prohibited from being elected to parliament if you oppose Israel existing as the state of the Jewish people, that would quite rightly strike us as a premise that is actually not particularly democratic at all. The nature of a state should be open for interpretation, for dispute, and its character should be open for interpretation and for dispute. That's very fundamental to what our conception of what a democracy is. Like, what is the state being used for? Who is it for? How would we describe it? Those are questions which democracy seeks to answer, regulate, and govern. So I think it's really important to kind of look at this, as you've rightly said, exclusive and discriminatory nature, because it really contradicts the idea that we're told over and over again that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, this is just one of dozens and dozens of examples of the way that Israel does not behave as what you or I would recognize, even in very limited form of Western democracy, as a democracy.
So we have to think this through. What if the United States was an explicitly Christian state, the way weirdo Republicans would like it to be, where only Christians had full citizenship and were considered nationals, and anybody else was considered second class and discouraged from immigrating? Hell, what if Canada was only for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and everybody else was a second class citizen? First Nations, Métis, Catholics, Jews, Italians, Germans, Ukrainians, Poles, Chinese, Japanese, and numerous other ethnic groups have been discriminated against in this country, usually for racist and or class-based reasons. Canada's racist and white supremacist history is basically about attempts to make a white Protestant state happen. And it's not a history most people are proud of. So why does it make sense to set up an exclusive ethno-religious group as the exclusive citizenry of another country? So we need to keep this in mind, especially when Israel's defenders talk about its so-called right to exist. It's a very exclusive kind of right that is being asserted here. Not simply the right to have a country with a lot of Jewish people in it, which few would find objectionable, but the right to have a country that is exclusively for Jewish people. You should note this whenever Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, mentions Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. The Jewish is an important qualifier to the democratic part there. And this gets even trickier when you get into the history and find out that, hey, Israel is setting up this state on land that has a ton of non-Jewish people living there. I wonder what the consequences might be. I wonder how fair this is going to be to the people that lived there before.
And all of this gets us into another weird thing, the law of return. The state of Israel claims to be a nation for Jewish people, not just that live in Israel, but for all Jewish people globally. Technically, that means Israel claims to be the state of a people who mostly don't live in Israel. But if you're Jewish, you can simply show up and declare yourself to be an Israeli citizen. Wherever you are in the world, you can arrive in Israel and are granted citizenship almost immediately. This basically is very dissimilar to what you find in immigration laws in other countries. Think of how involved and difficult it is to immigrate to any country in the global north, for example. It's very involved. There's all kinds of labor and educational requirements, fees, long waits, proving your familial relationships, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're Jewish and say, hey, I want to immigrate to Israel, you can basically just show up. So then this raises a bit of a question for living in Israel. Where are all these people who can just show up to Israel going to live when they get there? Well, great news, the state of Israel has figured out a way to acquire free real estate. Israel has what's called an absentee property law. For reasons that we will get into shortly, land in Israel is considered to be abandoned if the owners were absent for even just one day at any point after November 1947. And since then, additional laws and ordinances, along with some enormous separation barrier walls, have been created. But these two laws, they kind of really sum up the core of what Israel is about, the law of return and the absentee property law.
When it comes to land stewardship, you also have some interesting ways in which it gets managed within Israel. It would be pretty overtly discriminatory if the government just took the land and absorbed it and had an explicitly discriminatory policy directing how land gets used or allocated. So instead, what happens is that the state of Israel offloads or subcontracts these functions to other organizations like the Jewish National Fund or the World Zionist Organization. These very fine nonprofits and NGOs manage and develop the land in Israel, helping settlers to build settlements. Some of them even got criticized during the Obama years for continuing settlement expansion while Israel officially claimed that it had stopped. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that anything happened. The Jewish National Fund policy, which is official law in Israel, stipulates that only Jews can buy, mortgage, or lease lands that the Jewish National Fund controls. And to be clear, the Jewish National Fund holds about 13% of the land in Israel. It also has a major role in managing what's called Israel lands or government-owned lands. And so that's about 80% of the country. So we're talking here about 93% of Israeli land gets managed and developed specifically for the Jewish population. By comparison, the development budget for Arab and Palestinian areas of Israel, and this is within Israel, not the occupied territories, ranges from 1% to 4%, despite about 20% of the population within Israel being Arab or Palestinian. So you can see that there's some unequal treatment here in terms of land.
That was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm your host, Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Over 100 episodes from 2018 to 2021, the legendary 49th Parallel podcast welcomed listeners to long-form interviews with journalists, activists, and academics from across Canada and the international left, with host Rob Rousseau in Montreal. Now the show's back, and on this highlight from a December episode, Rousseau and Kaosetchin News reporter Camilla Press take a look at Canada and the Anglo-American Empire's decline, exploring how so-called Western values impact the Global South. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Hello, welcome to 49th Parahel, where we explore the hellish nightmare world of modern reality together. It's your friend Rob. It's nice to be back. I hope you're doing well. Happy holidays. Happy holidays, everyone. It's December 19th. This is always a little bit of a weird time of year, isn't it? I guess for me this year, it's even more weird than normal in many ways. Not necessarily bad, but it's definitely weird. And not always the easiest time. But, you know, with everything happening in the world right now, and all the horror that we've all been witnessing going on in Gaza over the last 2 months, it's really hard to feel anything other than grateful right now. You know, no matter what I have going on in my life, I can't help just but feel extremely lucky, you know, especially when it comes to my son. He's doing well. He's healthy. He's happy. It's his birthday coming up. He's about to turn 8 years old, which is really crazy. And even though I'm definitely very acutely aware of the unfairness of the fact that he's able to be, you know, comfortable and safe, whereas there's, you know, so many kids around the world that don't get to experience that. I guess the main thing I'm still holding on to at this time is just gratitude. You know, I feel I'm just, my heart is just filled with gratitude for that right now. And that's what I'm trying to hold on to this holiday season heading into the new year. And I hope you're all doing well too. In professional news, you know, this show just came back recently, but it's already making big waves in the Canadian independent media landscape. Very, very exciting, actually. And I got to thank a friend of the show, Jesse Brown of Canada Land, for highlighting some of the recent conversation that I had with Justin Potter and John Elmer on this show in one of his most recent episodes, when we discussed some of the journalism that Canada Land, or that Jesse, has been engaging in lately. So it was nice to get a little signal boost from someone that takes up so much space in Canadian media. Thanks again to Jesse for that. You know, it's nice. It's nice. This is the marketplace of ideas in action. We might not always agree. I might not always agree with someone like Jesse Brown, but it's beautiful when two people can, you know, share each other's work like that, promote each other, despite having these kinds of disagreements. That's what civil discourse is all about. And I'm happy to be a part of that. I have a really great episode coming up for you today. I spoke with Camila Escalante of Telesur Press TV, Kausachan News, a journalist that I followed for a while, whose analysis and commentary I really appreciate and respect. It was great to have her on the program. She's been on my Twitch stream before. But this is the first time we'll be talking in podcast form. And it was a really fantastic conversation. We talked a lot about Canada's kind of declining role in the world stage, the way that a lot of our so-called values have been exposed as being, how should I put this, a complete bullshit. This has been clear to me and probably many of you that are listening to this right now for a while. Canada has been, of course, supporting Israel to the hilt for many years now. This is not some new thing. Canada also obviously has been supporting and arming and funding and providing diplomatic cover to Saudi Arabia as they've been persecuting a genocidal campaign in Yemen over the last couple of years. I mean, this is not new to anyone listening to this. This is kind of a whole purpose of this show, is to talk about this and talk about the way that Canada's actual actions run completely contrary to the kind of image that we project out into the world. But I think this last 2 months have really, really spelled that out in crystal clear terms for many people, both here in Canada and around the world. And Camila was able to really speak to that in what I found to be a very kind of concise and entertaining way. She was cooking. There's no other way of describing it. She really was. I mean, we talked about a lot of things. It was really fantastic. We also spoke a little bit about this ongoing dispute, territorial dispute between Venezuela and Guyana over the Essequibo region, which is kind of an interesting geopolitical story that I've been keeping my eye on. It's not something I had a huge amount of familiarity with, so it's not something that I felt really comfortable, you know, forming some kind of strong take on. Because what sets me apart from a lot of other kind of journalists or commentators or whatever in this space is that I'm actually not very comfortable talking out of my ass about something that I don't fully understand. So, getting Camila's analysis of that was really helpful. Since we spoke last week, and since that time, there has been a sort of de-escalation that's gone on where, Guyana and Venezuela have mutually agreed not to use force to settle their dispute. And there does seem to be this effort to sort of calm down the tensions, which is a positive development. But I still think this conversation with Camilla about this was very interesting and illuminating. And not to, you know, spoil the whole conversation, but I think something that Camilla was talking about that really made a lot of sense to me and made a lot of things click into place was talking about this idea of sovereignty and what that means. You know, if you don't really have any kind of informed analysis of this, you might look at what Venezuela is saying about this Essequibo region and maybe come to the conclusion that, you know, they're violating Guyana's sovereignty. But it's a question of what sovereignty really means. And when you look at the U.S. government or the U.S. military or these big U.S.-based oil conglomerates like ExxonMobil and their connection to Guyana, it kind of makes it a lot more complicated. Is Guyana really sovereign if it's under the kind of sway of these Western imperialist forces? That's the kind of question I think we should be asking ourselves. And Camilla makes this point really interestingly. I don't want to step all over, her commentary and analysis of this, but I found that really pertinent and a way to understand the situation a little bit better. But you can apply the same logic to a lot of other places around the world. I mean, you can apply that logic to Ukraine. Look at what's been happening for the last 2 years with the Russia-Ukraine war. You might look at the news and look at the headlines and come to the determination that, you know, Russia is the imperialist force that's infringing on Ukraine's sovereignty. But is that really true? I know my stance on this kind of pisses some people off, but I'm not so sure. When you look at, you know, the role that NATO has played in Ukraine, not just over the last 2 years, but going back all the way to the Euromaidan 10 years ago now, or even beyond that. Is Ukraine really sovereign when you've got the U.S. government openly kind of infringing into its political and economic affairs or military, or, you know, threatening to park missiles there right on the doorstep of their neighbor that was once their greatest ally? You know, I'm not so sure. Is Ukraine really going to be sovereign if it gets totally pillaged by these Western financial interests and all its resources are totally privatized, all its public services are totally eliminated? You know, this is what's been going on there for a while now, and this process is probably going to be expedited when some kind of ceasefire or negotiated settlement, which seems inevitable now, finally happens, and which also, I should say, could have happened 2 years ago if it wasn't for Boris Johnson swooping in at the last moment to instruct the Ukrainians not to negotiate, which is kind of another example about how Ukraine has never really been a sovereign or free or democratic actor in this entire conflict. Anyway, these are all really interesting questions. We don't need to get sidetracked talking about Ukraine now. That's not really what this episode is about. But I think this question of sovereignty is a really interesting lens to kind of analyze these kinds of situations. So before Camilla joins the show, I would just like to remind folks that unlike Canada Land, this show is not bringing in, you know, whatever it is, five-figure per month in listener donations. Not that I've checked or anything. Who's counting? I'm not jealous. I don't even care. But if you do enjoy the show, or if you enjoy the work that I do, wherever you consume that, whether it's on Twitter or X, the Everything app, or Twitch or YouTube or whatever it is, please, if you can, subscribe and support the show. You can do so at patreon.com/RobRousseau. I think I've been talking about this for about 5 fucking years, but I think I am planning to do some exclusive Patreon content. You know, don't hold me to it, because this is something that I've consistently struggled to do over the years. But there is actually a big backlog of conversations that I've had online over the last 2 years that I would be interested in maybe turning into audio versions. So if you want to just kind of go back through the last 2 years and listen to different conversations that I've had with a number of really incredible writers, activists, analysts, journalists, all kinds of interesting folks, Vijay Prashad and Ben Norton and Carl Jha or Rania Kallik, Eugene Puryear, and I've done episodes with fellow Canadian journalists like Nora Loretto and Jeremy Appel and cartoonists like Ben Clarkson and Matt Boers. I spoke to them a few weeks ago, but their new comic, Justice Warriors, which is absolutely fantastic. I've had so many really wonderful conversations, so I am considering the idea of turning those into audio versions, which I could release on Patreon for the subscribers of this program. So if you do enjoy 49th Parallel, if you've gotten something out of it over the last few years that it's been on, minus the little pause that I'm just coming back from, please subscribe if you can on Patreon. Once again, it's patreon.com/Rob Rousseau. This podcast is part of the Harbinger Media Network. It's Canada's foremost collection of independent progressive podcasts. Very thrilled to be part of that. And I think that's all I have to say and all I have to plug. And let's get to this talk with Camila Escalante. It was really fantastic. It was a pleasure to speak with her. And you can hear that conversation right after this Soviet synth pop.
There we go.
Hey, awesome. Thanks so much for joining the show, Camila. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm sorry I was kind of flaky about the scheduling of this interview. I got a lot going on right now and the parenting stuff that I got to do, so it was difficult to find the time.
I hear that. That's everyone. I think we're at that age where everybody has to be a full-time parent.
Yeah. It's December, so it's my kid's school is on strike. And it's Christmas coming up and his birthday. He's a Christmas birthday guy. So tons of stuff we got to do right now. You just said you were traveling today. Where are you traveling from?
From Toronto via San Salvador. But I'm back home in Managua, Nicaragua. But I just had a bit of a layover due to a cancellation. So I should have already been here. I should have been home on the weekend.
Okay.
So it kind of just messed up my entire week. So I didn't feel the what you say is flakiness. I think it felt like more like Avianca was trying to ruin my week.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad we could find the time and schedule it. It's great to have you back on the show. It's been a while. I guess the thing that I wanted to leading into this conversation, I wanted to ask you, Canada just yesterday, I believe, finally signed on to the UN resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. As you know, obviously, Canada has been a pretty enthusiastic supporter of Israel in general and Israel's actions over the last 2 months. And now there's been this shift. We can speculate why that is, whether it's based on pressure from activists or whatever. Do you think it's enough? Do you think this is a positive thing from Canada, or do you think it's kind of too late for Canada or any other country that's subsidized and supported the genocide in Gaza to kind of wash away that stain by now calling for a ceasefire after 2 months and all the tens of thousands of deaths and the horrors that we've seen over the last 2 months?
Well, like I said, I've been traveling, so I've yet to see all of the sort of responses to this over the last day. But clearly it is the result of all of the protests and mobilization that have taken place here in Canada and elsewhere, or not here in Canada, I'm not in Canada anymore, but throughout Canada, certainly throughout its major cities, all of those actions that were taken against all of those companies that, for example, provide components for weapon systems to be traded to Israel or to be sent to the United States to then be traded to Israel. And, all of that pressure really has amounted to something, and it's amounted to something in the United States as well. I think that obviously this is not just an Israeli executed Holocaust of Palestinians in Gaza. It's actually something that's being committed by the United States. The United States needs its military power. It needs its colonial power there. And that's what Israel is. It's really not just U.S.
That was Rob Rousseau with Kausachan News reporter Camille Press on 49th Parallel. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Andre Goulet. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2020, Tech Won't Save Us is an award-winning left-wing tech podcast with a global listenership of tech workers, academics, journalists, and people who want a different perspective on an industry that holds so much power over our daily lives, with host Paris Marx of Newfoundland, now based in Montreal. On this December episode, Paris welcomes writer Astra Taylor for a conversation exploring how capitalism creates insecurity to sustain itself and the ways in which technology is used to heighten our insecurities. Here's Astra in Paris with a highlight from that conversation.
Part of my argument for how we get out of some of the messes we're in and change things so that we have more of that sort of material political security that we're talking about is that we actually have to face our vulnerability. And we have to say, okay, we're all insecure. Therefore, we need each other. And let's band together to fight for a world that meets our basic needs.
Welcome to Tech Won't Save Us. I'm your host, Paris Marx. And before we get to this week's guest, I just wanted to let you know about a little holiday giveaway that we're doing here on the show. So, as you know, the show relies on the support of listeners like you to keep making it, to keep having these fantastic conversations like the one that you're going to hear in just a minute. But if you have been on the fence for a while or considering becoming a Patreon supporter, now might be the time to do it. Because if you support the show before the end of the year, you know, by December 31st, you will be entered into a draw for one of five signed copies of Joanne McNeill's new book, Wrong Way. Remember, she was on the show just recently. Or five copies of my book, Road to Nowhere. So that is 10 books that you have the chance to win. And in order to enter, you need to sign up to become a Patreon supporter. And of course, if you're already a Patreon supporter, you will have the option to enter into that draw as well. But what better thing to do at the end of the year than to support a show that hopefully you enjoy very much and also get a chance to get a new signed book in the process. So give it a thought. If you want, you can pause the show right here. Go over to patreon.com/techwontsaveus and become a supporter, or, you know, just keep it in mind as you're listening. And so with that said, this week's guest is Astra Taylor. Astra is a writer, filmmaker, and political organizer. She's the author of The Age of Insecurity and a co-founder of The Debt Collective. I've been meaning to have Astra on the show for a while. We talked about it about a year or so ago and just had some scheduling issues. And I was so happy that we reconnected and could finally have her on the show to talk about her new book and, you know, some of the other work that she's been doing over the years that relates to technology, the tech industry, some of the subjects that we talk about quite often. And I think that this was an important conversation to have because it relates to a lot of the topics that we've been talking about, you know, over the past year and even longer, especially when you consider the difficulties that a lot of people, that workers face, and how the tech industry can make those things worse. As the title of Astra's new book suggests, it is about insecurity, something that more and more people, I think it's fair to say, are feeling in their lives, and something that we see the tech industry and their new kind of innovative, quote unquote, business models making even worse. So I was thrilled to have Astra on the show to dig into the book, to dig into her perspectives on these issues. You know, we talk a bit about some Canadian political stuff because Astra is also a Canadian and this book deals with some Canadian issues, but I'm sure you won't mind that. You know, you love hearing a little bit about Canada. So I don't want to make this intro too long, but I'll also just say, you know, obviously the holidays are upon us. So whatever it is that you celebrate, I hope you have a really great time, are able to spend some time with friends or family. And thanks so much for the fantastic year. Tech Won't Save Us wouldn't be possible with all of your listens and support. And I think that 2023 has been really fantastic for the podcast. And of course, you know, you're a big part of that. So thank you so much. With that said, if you enjoy this week's conversation, make sure to leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice. You can also share the show on social media or with any friends or colleagues who you think would learn from it. And if you want a chance at winning one of 5 signed copies of Joanne McNeill's Wrong Way, or one of 5 signed copies of my book, Road to Nowhere, while supporting all the work that goes into making the show possible, you can join supporters like Yuto in Tokyo, Keith in Cary, North Carolina, Mo from New York, and Peter in New Haven, Connecticut, by going to patreon.com/techwontsaveus, where you can become a supporter as well. Thanks so much, and enjoy this week's conversation. Astra, welcome to Tech Won't Save Us.
I'm so happy to be here.
Ah, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You know, we talked about it in the past for a bit and then took a break. But then, you know, you had this new book out based on, you know, some Massey lectures that you gave up here in Canada. And it was, I thought, the perfect opportunity to finally have you on the show and chat. So I'm happy to dive into that. And I'm sure so much more. And so, you know, let's start with the concept of these lectures and in this book, which is really insecurity. Why was this the thing that really drove you? And why did you feel compelled to explore this, you know, in much greater depth in these lectures?
Yeah. I just want to say I'm so happy to be on your show. And it's true, we talked about it years ago. And, you know, especially thanks for having me when this isn't an explicitly tech-focused book, though I chat about tech a little bit in it. The idea to write about insecurity actually was prompted from a conversation with Ben Tarnoff, who's one of the founding editors of Logic Magazine. I'm probably someone who's familiar to your listeners, who was putting together an issue of the magazine with the theme of security. And so he called me up asking if I might want to write for it. And, you know, I just remember saying in response, well, what if I talk about the way that capitalism is actually an insecurity generating machine, the way capitalism actually needs insecurity as much as it needs inequality. And so I ended up writing a piece for Logic called The Insecurity Machine that had a very tech focus, because that was actually the raison d'etre of the magazine, right? As that article, you know, wrapped up and went out into the world, I had this lingering sense that there was more to explore and that it was a sort of framework that I could apply to other realms in addition to tech. So looking at, you know, basic material conditions from housing and healthcare to things like education to human psychology, I just felt like it was one of those pieces that could actually be expanded. And the opportunity presented it itself when I was invited to give this year's 2023 Massey lectures in Canada. The challenge was essentially, you know, write a short-ish book in a matter of months so that they could have copies on hand. And then I got to deliver the five chapters or five lectures in five Canadian cities. And I did that in September. And so it was one of these concepts that kind of emerged out of, you know, sort of two prompts or invitations. You know, what I'm trying to show in the book is that insecurity is really central to the way that capitalism operates and that we need to be rendered insecure in order to be exploitable. And so I sort of use that as a lens to explore various social dilemmas. And it's one of those concepts for me, it spans the personal and the political, the economic and the emotional. And so, you know, it just kind of, I was able to sort of take it in all these different directions that I found pretty fun as a writer.
Yeah. And the book is fantastic. Like, as you say, it's not a totally kind of tech focused book, but there's so much to delve into there. And, you know, I found it really great as well, obviously being Canadian, but also knowing a whole lot about the States and writing about the States often, the kind of interplay that happens in the book and in that work between concepts in Canada and things happening in Canada and relating them to the United States as well. Like, I feel like I don't see so much of that. And, you know, I'm sure because, you know, you needed to relate it to a Canadian audience because you were up here. But I'm also hoping that, you know, maybe Americans pick it up and learn a bit more about things happening up this side of the world as well.
Yeah, it's my most Canadian book for sure. And that was, you know, really actually part of the pleasure of writing it was knowing that I'd have these lecture stops where I'd literally be speaking to people in Whitehorse, you know, in the Yukon Territory, or I'd speak to people in Halifax, and wanting to make it sort of resonant and relatable for those specific audiences, but also universal. And so a big chunk of it was excerpted in the New York Times when it came out. And, you know, my editor, after he read the book, he was like, oh, that's really interesting. Let's definitely write an excerpt. It does have a lot of Canada in it. But, you know, I think it's really important actually for Americans to learn more about Canada and not just invoke it as this idealized place, right? You know, so there's a rather long disquisition about the crisis of the public healthcare system. I think that that's important. But also, I did try to also pierce that veil of Canadian smugness throughout the book, too, and say, crisis of indebtedness in the United States that I, Astra Taylor, have been organizing around. But guess what? It's really bad in Canada, too. So hopefully, the lessons sort of flow both ways. And then in terms of the tech stuff, I mean, I used to write a lot more explicitly about technology ever since my first book, is The People's Platform and Taking Back Culture and Power in a Digital Age. It came out in 2014. And what I've done since then is, you know, try to just not silo tech as its own thing, to just write explicitly about tech, but to show that it's a facet of every aspect of our lives, right? Because it's part of our work experience, it's part of our education experience, it's part of healthcare, it's part of our social lives, it's part of our romantic lives. And to just, you know, sort of put it in there without cutting it off or reifying it or pretending that it's somehow separated from these other social fields.
Yeah, well, you talk about tech, and how you've been writing about tech for a long time, which I don't know, might surprise some listeners, maybe not. Maybe they're familiar with the People's Platform, maybe not. You know, I read the book, I think a little bit after it was released, but I found it a really great one. But that year as well, you know, you were also writing with friend of the show, Joanne McNeil, a piece in The Baffler called The Dads of Tech, I believe it was. You know, and I feel like that was a time when Silicon Valley itself was still very kind of idealized, you know, a lot of the reporting was still very positive on it. So I wonder kind of what you were seeing in that moment that was making you kind of look at this industry or these technologies in a different way than, you know, I think the public was still largely seeing them at that time.
Yeah, it's interesting to think back to that moment. I mean, it's almost hard, I think, sitting here today in 2023 to remember just how over the top and utopian some of the rhetoric about the internet was, specifically about social media and about the potential of these new tech companies to disrupt the old media monoliths and sort of get rid of middlemen. So there's this whole idea of disintermediation that we as citizens or as cultural producers or just as amateurs in whatever field would suddenly have this direct connection to, you know, one another, to our audience.
That was Paris Marks and filmmaker, writer, and activist Astra Taylor on Tech Won't Save Us. Find the show archives of nearly 200 episodes at techwontsave.us and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Andre Goulet. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, Unmaking Saskatchewan is an anti-capitalist, anti-colonial podcast about how the province of Saskatchewan was made and how it can be unmade, with Regina-based host Alex Burrell. On this highlight from a new episode, Alex sits down with ex-youth pastor Dallas Verity to discuss the reactionary rise of the evangelical movement and its doctrines in prairie politics. Here's Alex.
Hello, and welcome back to Unmaking Saskatchewan. I'm Alex Burrell, and I'm glad you're here.
I can hear the rustle of the wheat fields blowing softly on the plain.
As always, this episode was recorded on Treaty 4 territory, the homelands of the Nihia, the Anishinaabeg, the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota, and the homeland of the Métis Midship Nation. Today's episode is an interview with Dallas Verity, a former pastor in the Evangelical Church. Although evangelicals and Catholics and Anglicans, the churches that ran the residential schools in this province and were the greatest perpetrators of systemic colonial violence against Indigenous people outside of the state itself, often make strange bedfellows, the evangelical ideology is a deeply colonial one. And as we'll hear from Dallas, one of the primary goals of the Evangelical Church is to make converts of the world, including Indigenous people, meaning they're active participants in the ongoing colonization of these lands. When we think about the material promises of the treaties, material promises that we know have never been kept, we should consider what it means that the drafters of these treaties did not include within them a guarantee of protection of the free exercise of Indigenous faith traditions. If you want to support the show, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/unmakingsaskatchewan. The show is almost 2 years old, and the support from patrons really makes a positive impact on my ability to do the research and writing and interviews that keeps it going. A huge thank you to my supporters over there at the Strike Fund level and above: Jacqueline, Andrew, Courtney, Stefan, Devin, Nicole, Daniel, Bruce, Jeremy, Kevin, Riley, Rob, Brennan, Kieran, Julian, Brent, and Joel. It really means a lot to me. So today we will talk to Dallas, and in the next episode, we're going to do a deep dive into the evangelical movement in this province and its engagement with the conservative political project. Thanks for coming along. Okay. So I'm really excited to be joined today by Dallas Verity. Dallas, I wanted to bring you on because you're a Saskatchewan guy. You've got a bit of a history with the evangelical church, and you've been pretty outspoken about your arc from evangelical pastor to ex-evangelical. And so the influence of that particular strain of Christianity on politics in Saskatchewan, I think, is growing, and it's having some negative effects on public policy, particularly policy relating to queer people and queer youth in particular. And so I think it's kind of important to understand the way these churches function and the impact that their doctrines have on congregants and the wider social fabric. So welcome. If you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to the evangelical movement.
I guess as mentioned, my name is Dallas Barrett. He born in Swift Current, but lived my entire life in Regina. The joke always is that like I was raised or born into the evangelical church because like through the nursery, through Sunday school multiple times a year, youth group at a young age, I was, you know, I had young pastors or youth leaders saying like, you know, speaking prophecy over me to say, you know, you're going to be a pastor one day, you're going to shepherd the flock and other Christianese phrases. So I bought in at a young age, ended up going to, I spent my entire childhood and then early adulthood in the Christian and Missionary Alliance. Ended up right after high school going to Briarcrest, Briarcrest College and Seminary, which would definitely, I'd say they call themselves non-denominational, but definitely evangelical, and did an internship at a Christian and Missionary Alliance church, and then got hired at my home church in Regina that ended up working as a young adult pastor and then interim youth pastor for a couple of years. And yeah, I guess that's what, so I was deeply connected to the evangelical movement, particularly in Saskatchewan, working as a pastor and then attending a Bible school and seminary here as well. Shortly after I got married, my partner and I went and did a YWAM called a DTS school. So traveled around the world, and then you have like your schooling, which is like without any kind of the teachers don't have training or like PhDs or masters or anything, but they teach you biblical studies and how to evangelize properly, like to like professionally make other people Christians, or discipleship, they would call it. So that was in Panama, and then we traveled to Taiwan. Yeah, I did like an intensive month of evangelism, I guess, trying to convert the masses. So that was the connection for a long time.
Yeah, thanks for that. And so you said like two things there that immediately like kind of shot up. I don't want to call them red flags, but they're sort of like red flags of like, you know, converting the masses and like bringing people to Christianity. And like, is that like the primary goal? Like is as you're setting out to like bring people to the church?
So to put it really like bluntly, I've left that. I've left the faith of my youth. And I've done it in a pretty dramatic way, maybe, or public way. And some of the stuff I do now, especially advocating for the rights of people who are typically targets from the evangelical church, I'll jump kind of in between the kind of the Christianese or evangelical lingo. Any conversation I have from a justice or compassion standpoint is immediately met with like accusations of being woke, or I went down the slippery slope and now, you know, I left because I, whatever, sexual sin or whatever it is, there's some accusation. But if I can speak the language that I was raised in for, you know, 30 plus years. Anyway, so there's like bitterness and trauma mixed with the actual the language that I still try and speak sometimes.
I wonder, you know, I don't want you to have to get too personal or anything like that, but the experience of leaving the church, I imagine that must have been difficult. Is there a community within Saskatchewan of people who are, you know, who have formerly been with the evangelical church and have moved on from it? What is that experience like?
For sure. I think it's one of the most, I'm a peak privilege white cishet man living in Saskatchewan. So I get like, this is my level of, the hardship I've gone through is having to leave that faith community, because it's super isolating. I know I had listened back to some of your episodes, and one of the ones you say, like, not, I think it's the first one you say, like, nobody knows everything. And in my head, I'm like, I'm actually, if you ask my former evangelical youth self, I would have probably strongly disagreed. It was all about just being confident in your beliefs. Like, doubt is the opposite of faith is doubt, and like the doubt is Satan, is evil. So you never question things. If you do, you need to pray harder, you need to fast harder, you need to read your Bible more. So like for somebody to leave that can be very hard. And then for the community around who's had all of their values and certainties so implanted in their minds, it can be really isolating in particular, right? So you lose, I often say like, one of the best things that I've ever done was leave that system, but it's also one of the hardest things and most isolating. So I lost a lot of, you know, friends and family connections, especially working like as a pastor. There's a lot of, you know, accusations and like, well, you never really believed, you never really, you know, the faith wasn't real, Jesus didn't actually save you. Just lots of things like that. In 2018, I ended up connecting with like an old friend of mine who was also an ex-pastor who used to work in a different evangelical denomination. And we just started like talking about some of these things. And then we're like, hey, we don't have to be that lonely. If we're out here having these conversations, there's got to be so many other people. So we ended up like, I know, super cliche, two white guys starting a podcast. We ended up doing that. And it was like, and we learned a lot. And it actually, at that point, we still were like, we think we're Christians. We think maybe just evangelicalism is it for us. Because this was right after, I mean, talk about evangelicalism, like right after Trump's election. So that really rallied the evangelicals here as well. But we started like questioning some of these things, having these conversations, trying to listen to people who viewed the world or had worldviews either inside of Christianity, but not evangelicalism, or completely outside of Christianity. Can always be flawed communities as well. But yeah, it can be a very hard thing. And that's like a big reason why I still try and be as much of an open book as I can, is because like I left it and it was hard, and I have some of my dearest friends left it and it was extremely isolating. And I just know there's other people too who maybe just don't know that there's another way to view the world.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Did that election, that 2016 election, impact your decision to leave, or had you been planning for a while to leave or thinking about it anyway?
I think it was hard for my partner. Like, she's from Manitoba. Again, I was working at the time for my like childhood church, like born and raised in that congregation, worked in it. I was doing a job outside of the church at that point. But they had a youth pastor position posted. I was like, maybe I can do that. Maybe I can change this thing from the inside. And like, I convinced myself that this was going to be a good thing. But then through the interview process, and at that time I was like, the red flags are really going up for me. And I'm seeing like a lot of famous evangelicals and just like local evangelicals just being like, this guy, this Donald, he is, you know, there's Jesus. And then right there, what a phenomenal, holy, loving individual. So I was calling it out and just saying like this, like online and not even excessively, but enough. And then people, like I got sat down by somebody who was involved in the hiring process and was like, you can't do this. Like, this is a higher, you know, an upper class congregation, a lot of conservative leaning, like people here love Donald Trump, and it's not, you can't be doing that. I'm like, what? As a youth pastor, this should be exactly what I call it.
Those Alex Burrell and guest ex-youth pastor Dallas Verity on Unmaking Saskatchewan. Find more than 20 episodes in the show archives at harbingermedianetwork.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Harbinger Showcase has been brought to you by the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertaadvantagepod.com. And if you're in Montreal, don't forget to stop by the St. Jack's Centre this Saturday, January 13th from 8 p.m. for a night of media criticism featuring Habib Dupliez host Nash McCann, Tech Won't Save Us host Paris Marks, and Fortnite Parallels Rob Rousseau with an eclectic group of guests including the Palestinian Youth Movement, Breach Media, Sarah Club Canada, and more, plus an after party connecting left journalists and activist communities. That's all happening this Saturday, January 13th at St. Jack's at 1439 Rue Saint-Catherine West near Concordia University. Tickets are $15 and the venue is licensed BYOB, so bring some drinks and friends for a night of media criticism. Hopefully see you there. Subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for weekly updates on new episodes from Canada's cross-country community of more than 60 socially and politically progressive podcasts. You can support our work for as little as $5 a month, and we'll send you a free new release from Between the Lines Books or Fernwood Publishing. You can do it with a credit card in about 5 seconds at harbingermedianetwork.com. If you can, come help us out. Music on the show is courtesy of Creative Commons and Jason Shaw, and Blink-182's All the Small Things karaoke version from Sing King on YouTube. You've been listening to the debut episode of Season 2 of Harbinger Showcase. Find the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
It is imperative upon us as activists, as I think Jewish activists, to push back against those organizations and institutions that are normalizing this behavior, that are normalizing genocide, because that's what's happening, is a genocide of a population. And ultimately, at the end of the day, none of this makes Jewish people safer. None of this makes the diaspora any safer. And in fact, that benefits Israel to a large extent.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to another edition of La Hora del Ruido. My name is Jose Podrido, and you are listening to CKUT 90.3. Today, I'm going to be playing a quick set list of new releases that I came across lately. The first song comes out of a demo from a band from Indonesia called Ox. This song is called Metode Adiksi.